Tuesday. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and whether you picked up cooking and baking at home for the first time during the pandemic or you've been cooking at home for years, a Wisconsin cookbook author has advice on becoming the best home cook you can be. First, over the summer, 99 scientists achieved a major milestone, something that's been decades in the making. They completed the full sequence of the human genome. Back in 2003, then-President Bill Clinton announced the completed first draft of the human genome.
We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome. Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind.
As he said, though, that was a survey, and there were still some gaps. For the next few decades, about 10% of the genome remained unknown. Now, after some more years of work, scientists have cracked that last 10%, and with it, they've discovered millions of new differences among individuals and over 100 functional genes. We're talking now about the completion of the human genome and what it means for research, maybe for medicine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the completion of the human genome map? How do you think this could change science? Do you have an inherited condition, or does a genetic disorder run in your family? How is being able to know that if you've had one of those genetic profiles changed your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Chris Saha is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at UW-Madison and co-chair of the National Institutes of Health Somatic Cell Genome Editing Program. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Chris, can you take a little time to explain what the human genome is? What is this thing that we have this now complete map of?
Yeah, the human genome and the genome in general typically refers to the set of instructions for the cell. It's a blueprint to make our own bodies. And so it typically refers to the DNA, but it can also include associated proteins and also messenger RNA that the cell also uses to encode information. The saying goes that we have 99.9% of our genome the same between two different people, and it's the 0.1% that makes us who we are. I think the completion helps us get a really fine grain picture of exactly, you know, the 100% of the genome, and gives us a map of how to think about that 0.1% difference that could be so important.
I think I grew up with an overly simplistic notion, Chris, of how genes work. The idea that, okay, if you have gene A, it's going to flip this switch. If you have gene B, it's going to flip that switch, and that's the end of the story. These things are a lot more complicated than that, right? Could you talk about the complex systems that arise from our genes and the proteins they create?
Sure. I mean, so these genes interact. It could be that if gene A is on and gene B is off, you get, you know, let's say one type of trait, blue-colored eyes. If you have both of them on, you might have black eyes, et cetera. So that's really among typically a small number of genes that biologists and clinicians have figured out that can be kind of related to one particular behavior or trait. We're now in the territory when you think about the whole genome of thousands of different genes that are coming together to give us all of the different functions that each of our cells do. So that level of data and analysis is really staggering in some ways. So I think this new version has mapped out 19,969 protein coding genes. And so that's that many different proteins that can either stick to one another, can really affect how they function within a cell. And one small amino acid change, one letter in the human genome, could render one of those proteins totally non-functional. And when that happens, that could perhaps be a central hub in thousands or hundreds of other proteins coming together to properly make a cell work. So for instance, one of the diseases that we study in my lab is an inherited retinal disorder. And we found that one single base pair change, if you inherit it from your mom, for instance, could stop your photoreceptors in the back of the eye from sensing light. And it leads to an inherited form of blindness. And we really can only find that out by looking at the right place in the human genome, identifying that gene, looking at every single protein in that that's encoded by that gene, and then find the one amino acid that's different in one of the two copies of that gene that you have in that patient. And so, you know, this is going from 3 billion letters down to one. It's really like having a needle in a haystack to identify, you know, potentially one gene and then one base of that gene that's problematic. That's important for us because then we can start to figure out how to address that change. And some of the tools that we're working on in the consortium you mentioned, the genome editing consortium funded by taxpayer dollars at the NIH, is developing new ways to go in and fix, you know, the letter that, and the base that's changed specifically in the back of the eye without hitting any other parts of the genome.
We're talking to Chris Saha, Associate Professor of Biomedical Engineering at UW-Madison, looking at the completed map of the human genome and the research and possible therapeutic uses of that information. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Annie is with us in La Crosse. Annie, hi.
Hi. Say, to start out, I want to say that Medicare does not pay for genetic testing in cancer. I had uterine cancer, and my father died very young of colon cancer, and there can be a genetic relation there. But because Medicare doesn't pay for it, we just had to do kind of like a family tree thing. But, you know, the problem is my grandparents came from Russia, so who knows what happened back there, and they all died from other stuff before they were even my age. So I just want to say that was what I wanted to say, is that Medicare does not pay for genetic testing.
Annie, thanks for the call. Now, without getting into the funding model for this, are we at a point, Chris, where we can gain useful information about, say, in Annie's case, future cancer risk if we are able to get a good profile of all or part of her genome?
Yes, there's a lot of people working on this, including a lot of folks at UW-Madison. There's something called genomes that you can get from blood, so circulating cancer genomes. And these this discovery has been made, I would say, arguably over the last decade or two. And if you're able to compare the sequence of those cancer genomes to the regular genome that you would find in a healthy cell, you can start to map out differences that give you a snapshot of what's happening specifically within the cancer. So this is being used more and more for diagnostic purposes. It helps us give us a very detailed picture of what people call driver mutations of these cancers. So unfortunately, in some of our cells, as they make copies, you can develop these driver mutations that lead to abnormal behavior in cancer. Some of those occur during the lifetime of a patient. It could come from some sort of mutational hit to the bodies. For instance, if you're exposed to sun quite a bit, you may see those arise de novo or new after a lot of sunlight exposure. More often, it can be mapped to what people call germline or inherited mutations from parents. to give you risk alleles. So BRCA1 is one of these most famous risk alleles for breast cancer. And so if you're able to start to decode what these genes are showing and establish variants that are associated with cancer progression and risk, then you're able to come up with different treatment regimens for them. And I would say this is still, unfortunately, a research question for many types of cancers. We are doing that here in Madison. And as soon as, you know, we see the value of it in clinical trials, then it has to go through the process of getting reimbursed. That can take years, if not maybe decades in some cases, which is frustrating, as I could sense, but that's where we are. Certainly this new picture will give us potentially new areas of the genome to look at for risk alleles for cancer.
Annie, thanks for sharing your difficult story. I appreciate you calling in. Chris Saha is with us, Associate Professor of Biomedical Engineering at UW-Madison. He's talking to us about the complete sequencing of the human genome, what it can mean for disease detection, for example, and maybe treatment. We'll get into that a little more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what this means, this information from the human genome, and what potentially could be done with it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now with UW-Madison Biomedical Engineering Associate Professor Chris Saha about the completion of the mapping of the human genome, a project 20 years plus in many ways in the making. You can join in with your questions about what this all means, the potential for future research, for future medical treatments, maybe using that information at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or something maybe in your life that you think might have been helped if you had that information. 800-642-1234 is the number. Chris, let's talk about potential treatments. And let's go back to that research you were working on with colleagues that you mentioned earlier about that one amino acid change that can affect vision so severely. Are we at a point where now that we know where that is, at some point we can edit that amino acid, we can tweak it and fix the problem?
Yeah, I believe we're getting very, very close to doing this in patients. Thus far, my work with colleagues here have done it in human cells that have the change in the amino acid. And what we see is when we fix it in the cells, they rescue the function so they can help support phototransduction and we get the proper protein expressed. And this is using some of the genome editing tools that we've been developing in my lab and has been developed at a really rapid pace over the last 8 years or so. And this is the CRISPR family of genome editors. And one of the questions that we have in the field is, could we deliver enough of this through a single injection into the eye to hit enough of the tissue in the eye to give a therapeutic response? And we're working on new ways to deliver those types of genome editors into the back of the eye. We have ideas of using viral vectors. We have ideas of using polymers and kind of shrink wrap type of coatings to these systems to get them into the right cells to hit the right gene. You know, just practically in terms of how we go about this research, we know where we want to edit. One concern that the FDA has is how do you know that you're not accidentally hitting other parts of the genome? And what this more complete human genome gives us is a more detailed map and ability to measure whether we've hit the other part of the genome. Because, you know, if we have a map that's arguably 90% complete and we're trying to figure out where we're trying to, how to edit it, and essentially 10% of it is just blank, we're not sure whether whether we've hit that 10% that's blank. And now that we have a full picture, we can, I think, more safely develop some of these therapeutics such that we don't accidentally hit the other, you know, previously uncharted 10%.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Carol is with us in Mauston. Carol, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Carol?
Well, I've always been interested in getting my whole genome done, and I'm wondering how soon it will be when that can be done in a meaningful way to my own individual characteristics.
Carol, thanks for the call. And I know there are services, Chris, of course, lots of ancestry services, for example, some do it for medicine, that map, I think, at least some of our genome, but not the whole deal, if I'm not mistaken. How much effort does it take to take Carol, say, and map out her personal genome?
I think it's doable now. There are services, and the sequencing technologies that were used in this newest version of the human genome can kind of read longer bits of the genome at a time. If you think about reading, you know, the 3 billion code, we would before read about 100 to 1,000 sequences of it at a time and then assemble it together. Now we can read millions, maybe tens of millions of bases at a time, and it's much easier to assemble those bits into the whole genome. And I think the prices and the prices have gone down because the technologies have gotten quite a bit better. And if it's really kind of a important question for a clinical treatment, then it can actually be reimbursed in some cases. There are groups in the country and in research hospitals that have cohorts of patients that are called like the Undiagnosed Disease Network. And what they do is their constellation of symptoms doesn't really map to any known disease. And in that case, you would go and try to map and sequence the whole genome. It is expensive, so that's not typically standard of care for really many type of disorders, or you know, especially if you're healthy, because it is quite a significant investment to do that, but it can be done.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that call, Carol.
Research.
That's okay. We're talking to Chris Saha, Associate Professor of Biomedical Engineering at UW-Madison. Thanks for the call, Carol. And Chris, I want to spend a couple minutes on an implication of Carol's question. I know people are hoping that we can have some sort of personalized medicine where with detailed genetic information, we'll know that Carol might have one propensity for a disease, I might have a different one, she might respond to a medication in one way, I might respond to it differently. What kind of hope do you have that we're going to reach that point of personalized medicine in our lifetimes?
Yeah, I think we're incrementally getting there. And it's when the stakes are high, you know, for instance, picking the right therapeutic when you're at a late stage cancer, doing really personalized genetic sequencing can be quite fruitful. And that's already the case. There's oncology teams and research hospitals that regularly do this now. In many cases, it's not as straightforward as finding one single genotype that will explain a very important kind of medical outcome or make a clinical decision. You know, easily right now, because our understanding of the genome is still quite, you know, partial and incomplete. So I think these types of technologies, when we're mapping the genome better, we're editing it and perturbing it in new ways to find out how various parts and genes of the genome come together and function, as we link that to behavior, we'll get more and more personalized type of treatments. And so, you know, in some ways, I think it's kind of like micro-targeting ads in social media. The more data you get by reading the genome, the better off we'll get in terms of treatment. But it's not like we flip a switch and all of a sudden we'll have personalized medicine.
It's a good place to leave it, Chris. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me. This was fun.
Chris Saha is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at UW-Madison and co-chair of the National Institutes of Health Somatic Cell Genome Editing Program. He joins us today to look at the completion of the mapping of the human genome, what it means for future research and possibly for medical treatment in the not-too-distant future. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we'll dig into some secrets behind a great home-cooked meal from start to finish. Our guest is a Wisconsin author of a brand new cookbook, sharing her love, for, among other things, of home cooking. She'll make the case to encourage us to do more of it, and then lots of advice on making great and tasty food and avoiding some traps and pratfalls that hit us along the way. She's got a few recipes for us, too, by the way, and you can check them out. Get a head start over at WPR.org/Food Friday. I heard something about some maple pork chop arrangement. That sounds pretty good. A great northern bean soup, too. Lots of great fall foods available there. Find them right now at WPR.org/Food Friday, and you can start the conversation right away on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Have you gotten more into home cooking over the last, say, year and a half? Back into it? Renewed your efforts, whatever the case may be. Love to hear your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, a lot of federal money has come to Wisconsin from COVID relief bills. Find out what it's being used for and what's still in the pipeline. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, during the pandemic, with restaurants often closed or just offering limited menus for takeout or delivery, a lot of folks spent more time and energy actually cooking in their own kitchens. There was a period, too, when people got hooked on pandemic baking and caused even a shortage of materials for making things like bread, cookies, pies, and so on. It's Food Friday, and our guest says, let's take this burst of energy for home cooking and run with it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you learn to cook or bake for the first time over the last year and a half, or learn to cook or bake something new in that time span? Has it all changed how you look at food and eating and cooking? What's that experience been like for you? Do you have some momentum and you're going to stick with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer Rood-Klett is a journalist and food writer and author of the new cookbook, Home Cooking Comeback, Neighborly Advice and 40 Pleasing Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be back on Central Time, and this time talking about food on Food Friday.
And Jennifer, could you just share your love and encouragement, because that's a lot of what your book is about, encouragement for people to do more cooking at home.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of good reasons why you should cook at home, okay? I mean, we all know it tastes better. It's less expensive to cook at home. It allows you to be self-sufficient in feeding yourself. It's a great way to have much more control about your health and it allows you to also create those wonderful food memories. And all of those things were present, but once the pandemic hit, I think many of these aspects about home cooking just intensified and ratcheted up. And I think a lot of people were trying things for the first time, and I find it absolutely fascinating that one of the reactions to the pandemic was baking.
And can you talk about your philosophy of home cooking? Going through your recipes and your advice, this isn't super fancy stuff. It's not persnickety, cranky recipes that we got to do just right. Talk about what goes into making a great home cooking recipe for you.
Yeah, I don't really do persnickety. you know, being a food writer, I've had to write about a lot of different foods, and I pretty much just focus on foods from Wisconsin. So I love to do local seasonal things in my own kitchen as well. And I've learned so many things. Every single story I've written, I've learned things about food. And one of the things I've learned is that there's a lot of bad recipes out there. So I try to really seek the best recipes. For example, I was many recipes that you find online, and if you look for a recipe online, it can be a huge time suck. You don't know if it's going to be any good, and oftentimes they're very complicated. And so I always look for simplicity and kind of let the ingredients do the talking, or I should say the tasting. And, you know, another thing I do is that I kind of embrace imperfect cooking. So never let perfection be the enemy of the good applies here. You know, if you're looking to be flawless and produce these just wonderful social media worthy of photos of food, it can be intimidating and paralyzing, demoralizing. And that's the last thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to just encourage people, especially people that are just starting out to bake and cook, to not give up. And I think the cookbook offers a lot of realistic advice.
We're talking to Jennifer Rude Klett from here in Wisconsin. Her new cookbook is Home Cooking Comeback, Neighborly Advice, and 40 Pleasing Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you gotten into or back into home cooking and or baking, especially during the pandemic? Where do you go for reliable recipes? Is there a website you found, a favorite cookbook that you have, a family hoard of recipes that's been passed down through the generations, maybe? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer, you shared a few recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. They're all very fall appropriate, I got to say. Let's start with one, a great Wisconsin ingredient that stays good all year round, maple syrup in your slow-cooked maple pork chops. Tell us about these, please.
Yeah, so the exact recipe is available on your website, but these are phenomenal and, again, really fall appropriate. We just got some fresh apples from an apple farm. And so this incorporates, you want to get 4 thick pork chops. And if you can get the bone in, that's a little bit better for a slow cooker. You're going to increase the flavor a little bit more. And then if you could score some smoked pork chops, do it. It just takes it up a notch. And then we add in a little bit of maple syrup, extra virgin olive oil, dry red wine, some thyme, and then you want to slice up an apple. And it doesn't really matter what kind, just slice it up into big chunks. You don't need to put the core in there. A little salt and pepper, and you keep that in the slow cooker for a while. And you can brown the pork chops before you put them in the slow cooker. Or what I have is I have a slow cooker that will brown, has browning capabilities, but you don't have to. So if you don't want to, you know, fuss and you just want to get something in the slow cooker before you leave for the day,
just throw it all in there, turn it on, and you'll come home and you'll feel like a hero.
And Jennifer, you said a little maple syrup, and something I've definitely encountered cooking with maple syrup or making cocktails with it, a little bit of maple syrup goes a long way. Do we have to be careful not to just overwhelm everything with the maple?
Yeah, of course. You know, maple syrup is really intense in calories and flavor and sugar content. The maple pork chops just call for 2 tablespoons. So it's really not a very big amount. I did a newspaper story on maple syrup, and for some reason, I just became very fascinated with maple syrup and how unique it is to Wisconsin. So maple syrup is indigenous to North America, and it's generally produced in the northern areas near the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Seaway, because that's where maple trees grow. And so it turns out maple trees are more than just eye candy with their striking leaf color. They're also amazing sources of food. And we've got like 270 licensed maple syrup producers in the state, and I like to call them tree farmers. And the Home Cooking Comeback features 5 recipes that call for maple syrup. And it's, you know, I broke the book down into 9 chapters, all featuring Wisconsin grown or produced or raised products in there. And maple syrup got more than its fair share of recipes.
We're talking to Jennifer Rudklat about her new cookbook, Home Cooking Comeback, Neighborly Advice and 40 Pleasing Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. Find a few of those recipes, including those slow cooker maple pork chops at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you could join the Food Friday conversation right now at 800-642-1234. What home cooking or baking successes or failures have you had in the last year or so? Do you have cooking advice that you like to share with your neighbors or family members? Where do you go for great, reliable recipes that work out every time? Share your secret recipe source, whether it's a cookbook, a newspaper column, an online source, a family member, let us know about it. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk now with Jennifer Rudklat about her new book. It's called Home Cooking Comeback, Neighborly Advice and 40 Pleasing Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. She says, hey, if you have gotten more into home cooking over the pandemic, don't stop. Keep it up. And she's got advice on how to do that. Make great recipes. Find great recipes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something new in your kitchen that you got into over the last year and a half? Tell us about it, how it went. If there was a learning curve, your favorite successes, your most hilarious failures, if you'd like. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And also answer the question, where do you go for recipes? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer, also in your book, in addition to the recipes divvied up by great Wisconsin ingredients, you share some traps that home cooks often run into that you hope you can help us avoid. Can you give us 1 or 2 of those?
I think one thing that you're going to learn with experience with home cooking and baking is that there are some occasions to splurge and there's some occasions to save money. So when you're out shopping, for example, I found that white granulated sugar, I found absolutely no discernible difference in the quality despite a wide range of price. So my advice is to just get the cheapest generic sugar you could find. But this is not true across the board with all food. So sometimes it really does pay to buy that more expensive ingredient, because when you cook at home, it takes a lot of time and effort. And the last thing you want to do is to have your ingredients sabotage your efforts. One of the things I wanted to mention that's really important is flour. I did a newspaper story on milling, on fresh milled flour and how important it is. And I write that I think a lot of people
could use a flour intervention in their kitchen, because if you're just using AP or all-purpose flour, as we call it, you're really, really missing out on a whole world of flavor and nutrition. So no one to splurge and no one to save. And the other thing I think was really underscored in the pandemic is the, local boards, food have been nagging us for so long to shop local. But I think it was really driven home during the pandemic when you saw centralized food chains dry up or fail. So, you know, when you went to the store, you didn't see flour, you didn't see yeast, you didn't see meat. And I think this really drove that home. People were panicking. And every story I did about food during the last 18 months, you know, on garlic, on dry beans, on beef, on freshly milled flour, the local producers said you just would not believe the demand. So these local producers are so important to food security in Wisconsin.
Want to check out another recipe you shared with us. I love making soup this time of year. You've got a soup with great northern beans. It's a great northern bean soup is the recipe. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Great northern bean soup is one of my six soups that I make on a regular basis. I've got two soup recipes in Home Cooking Comeback. And I just want to mention, too, if you'd like any information, additional information about Home Cooking Comeback or know when I'm going to be making personal appearances, they're all on my website, which is jrudeklett.com. So dry beans are what go into the Great Northern Bean Soup, and I am a huge fan of cooking with dry beans. And Great Northern Bean Soup is one of those soups I make that when I'm tired and I don't have a lot of energy, I make this soup because it's the absolute easiest soup of all time, and it's very healthy. It's really good at keeping your weight down and makes a really good weekday supper. Pair it with a BLT or hot ham or a fried egg sandwich, you know, with a hunk of cheddar on there. For a meatless option, or even a grilled cheese, or even, you know, just some crusty bread is really good with this. You're basically just taking carrot, celery, and onion, and one clove of fresh garlic, and you're just kind of browning that for just a few minutes. And then what you want to do is you want to add in a 6 cups of reduced sodium chicken broth, which is kind of a cheat. I do make my own broth, but hey, sometimes you got to use the canned, right? A bay leaf, salt and pepper, and then I put in 4 cans of Great Northern beans, rinsed and drained, and a little parsley on top. And you pretty much just have to boil it to make sure that the carrots are soft, and it gets better with each reheat, you know, smashing the beans all along the side of the pan. And it's just great, great comfort food and super healthy.
You can find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's bring out a caller now. Rick is with us in Monona. Rick, hi.
Hey, enjoying your show. I'm one of those people that during the pandemic actually took up cooking big time. We used to have a stable of recipes that we used, but they got kind of old. So I started watching the Test Kitchen on Wisconsin Public Television and Milk Street. And if I saw a recipe I liked, I'd record it and then I'd play it back and I'd write it down. And then we'd try it. And it was phenomenal. It changed our diet. We're now eating Vietnamese and Chinese and Middle Eastern and Italian. And it's just wonderful. And my family noticed, and I've sort of become the hero of the kitchen.
Wow.
So I highly recommend trying it. It's
Rick,
it's really revolutionized everything. All of our food that we eat now has fish sauce in it or miso or that kind of stuff. I never, ever thought we'd be using that in our kitchen, but but here it is.
I love it. Rick, can you share, before we let you go, a favorite dish from this experience, from your revolutionized kitchen?
Well, one of them was called molletes, which is it's a black bean, like a fried rice, or excuse me, refried black beans with all kinds of spices in them, and then you put it on toast and then top it with cilantro and some kind of Mexican cheese. And it's one of our family favorites.
I love it. Rick, thank you so much for sharing that. We've got Jennifer Rood-Klett with us. Her new book is Home Cooking Comeback. And I'm hearing, Jennifer, from Rick, you know, and I've been there too. You're kind of in a rut. Make the same stuff in the kitchen again and again. What do you recommend people do to try to shake out of that rut and bring something new into the equation?
Yeah, Rick had a great testimony there. What I try to do is, as I had mentioned, I learn something from everybody I talk with when doing a food article. So I encourage people that have been cooking for a while or have been lax in cooking at home to remain teachable. And there's a lot of great sources out there that, you know, that Rick was talking about, America's Test Kitchen and so on. And, you know, he's what he's doing now is he's creating this wonderful food memories. And if you're really, really blessed in this world, you can remember when somebody you loved and loved you made you something to eat. And those are just some of the sweetest memories you could ever have. Remember, we're all going to pass away someday, but our phenomenal cheesecake recipe can live forever.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Just in our last minute, I want to amplify something you just said, Jennifer. You talk about in the book the joy of cooking, not just for yourself or just for your household, but look for opportunities to find people who need a little boost and make something for them. Make the case that maybe we should try that this weekend.
Absolutely. So I broke down the book into neighborly advice in the beginning, and then I have my 40 recipes. And to close out my neighborly advice to people, I talk about cooking for others. And what I'm basically saying is that, you know, you can have the absolute worst day in the world, but if you have a hot bowl of homemade chili with melted cheddar cheese and warm chocolate chip cookies, it's really going to help you. And the same goes for someone else. So home cooking is just not about the food, just about the food. It's about the gesture. It's about our culture as people. So let's not lose it. And when you cook or bake something for someone else, you help raise that person up as well as yourself.
Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us on Food Friday.
My pleasure.
That's Jennifer Rood-Klett, a freelance writer and author. And we talked to her today about her new book. It's her first cookbook. It's called Home Cooking Comeback, Neighborly Advice and 40 Pleasing Recipes from the Farm Kitchen of a Midwestern Food Journalist. Well, if you're looking for some home cooking, some recipe ideas to make for yourself or share with others, we've got a few of them that Jennifer shared with us. You can find them online right now at WPR.org/Food Friday. We heard about the great northern bean soup there. That sounds great. The slow-cooked maple pork chops and a bonus, some dessert, pecan pie or pecan pie, if that's the way you lean on that, with a northern twist. All great fall recipes, all available for you at WPR.org/Food Friday. Take pictures if you make them. Send them along. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a new report looks at the experiences of local Wisconsin election officials in 2020. The report's author joins the show to tell us what we learned, what it could mean for future elections. President Biden issued a wide-ranging COVID vaccine mandate that could affect millions of Americans. We'll look at the impact of that decision, the legal issues surrounding it, and the backlash against it. Plus, lots more women than men are going to college these days, and that gap seems to be widening. We'll find out what is behind that trend. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Now, what's the deal with squirrels? I've been wondering that lately. It's been on my mind, and so has Central Time producer Bill Martins. Hey, Bill.
Yeah, Rob, it's weird. It's like a regular squirrel amusement park in my backyard. They run around. They've got walnuts in their mouths. They're digging up the yard, and then they're patting it down like a cat making biscuits. I've got a couple of sprinklers in the yard with, that are set to timers, so sometimes the sprinkler will go off when there's a squirrel nearby. It'll get wet and freak out, and they make really weird sounds, too. Like, what's up with that?
And are you putting these on your TikTok channel, Bill? Oh, wait. Do you have a TikTok?
I should.
You should.
I don't, but I should. I can make a lot of money with this, I think.
And what's been on my mind is, okay, my strategy as a squirrel is I find a thing, I bury it, I forget where I buried it, and I just look for loose bits of earth, whether it's the food I planted or the thing that Rob plants next spring, whatever. I don't know. It doesn't seem like a good survival strategy. I'm thinking we do a segment on squirrel intelligence. What do you think?
I think there's at least 45 minutes in that. I mean, there's a lot of material there. Great stuff.
I'm hearing series, actually.
Maybe
a whole new syndicated program. What's the deal
with squirrels?
It's squirrel time. Squirrel time with Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks, Bill.